afternoon, everyone, or good evening or good morning, depending on when you're watching. If you are joining us live, please let us know, hashtag live. If you're joining us in the replay, let us know, hashtag replay. You have been joined. You joined hashtag no limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag no limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. And Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will become. And you can kind of see most of my poster is that phrase behind me. You miss a few of the words, but I believe that to be 100% true. And I believe that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. We know that the caterpillar dissolves into its cells and then reforms into the butterfly. And then it's not finished struggling. It has to fight and build strength in its wings to get out of the cocoon in order to be able to be strong enough to fly. And while that is no easy task, neither is busting through those limits that society has placed upon a person. And today, my guest is Gina Waterman. And Gina has, she does something that I don't think is probably talked about enough in the world of people with special needs or people with disabilities, and that's she talks to families about the grief. And so I'm not going to get into that too much right now in the introduction. She and I will get into that more as we talk. So make sure that if you are watching that you give us a thumbs up, you give us a like, you subscribe to the channel so that you don't miss. I was looking for my my little thumbs up there. You don't want to miss. My brain just can't work today. You don't want to miss any episodes of Hashtag No Limits or Friday with Fran. So Gina, thank you. I'm stumbling all over myself here. Thank you for joining me and for being on Hashtag No Limits. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on this. I'm really excited.
Yeah, absolutely. So you reached out to me. I forget exactly how you found out about me, but when you told me what you did, I felt like you were an absolutely perfect fit for Hashtag No Limits. So tell the audience who you are and what your background is.
Okay. I think we met through a mutual special needs associate. I'm not going to say he's a father, but I think he might be a sibling. Anyway, on LinkedIn. And it was Special Strong. I do remember that.
Okay.
In the Dallas
there we go.
Community. So I am a grief recovery specialist. I work with the Grief Recovery Institute out of the West Coast in Oregon. And I've been doing that for a couple of years. I saw a need when I took the training for myself, actually, to complete some work on some grief and loss that I was dealing with. It was really basically just I was stuck and I needed some serious help at that time. So when I took the training, I thought, you know what, this is like the perfect thing that we all need as parents, because there's another level of grief that no one speaks about and talks about. It's there. It's staring us in the face all the time, as mothers, as fathers. But I deal a lot with mothers just because I am one myself, and I'm in all the groups over the last over a decade. And it's the unmet hopes, dreams, expectations that we've had for our child. And that is that's a loss. So the curriculum that we use with GRM, Grief Recovery Method, is excellent. It's the only thing that's really helped me to get to the other side. I've done years and years of therapy and marriage counseling, et cetera, to get through some things. And this was something that was so profound and had such an impact on me in such a short time that I needed to get it to other people. So that's what I do right now.
I've tried to spell your name and I keep messing it up. Oh. Yeah, the mental health side of things is so often overlooked. And sadly, it seems as though many people will say, oh, counseling is fine for someone else. You know, they'll be fine as long as it's not them going to the counseling. For some reason, I feel like we still have the stigma associated with seeing a counselor or a therapist or a psychologist or whatever title that you give to that person.
Absolutely. There's a stigma that still exists and will always exist, I think, unfortunately, in our society, especially, I mean, we're Americans, but it's throughout. The grief recovery method is international now, and they say the same thing, you know, that people are, you have to really hit some of them rock bottom in order for you to find this and really say, I really need help. I can't get through this anymore. I can't survive another day. It's definitely a stigma. I wish it wasn't. I'd like to say that in, you know, 5-10 years from now, I hope to still be doing this and grow and have other people under me delivering the actual training, that it wouldn't be so shameful or bad to seek help, because we all need help.
Right. And I don't know how many of these episodes that you've seen, and I actually don't know how often I've spoken about it on hashtag No Limits. My other show that I do, Friday with Fran, she and I talk a lot about mental health. And in those episodes, I've mentioned many times that I have seen a counselor for years. And right. I highly recommend, I happen to have a couple of things early on in my life that affected me later in life, but I don't really have those big things anymore, but I still go see that counselor because it's so wonderful to have that person who is willing to just sit and focus 100% of their attention on me and listen to what I am going through and just give me ideas or say, yeah, I think the way you're handling that is a good way to handle that, a healthy way to handle it. There's a lot of ways to handle things. And unfortunately, a lot of people tend to handle them in unhealthy ways.
Correct.
And, I feel a much more calming sense because I have that objective party who doesn't, you just don't share, at least I don't share with those that I know personally in the same way that I share things with my counselor.
And you can't, and you probably shouldn't, honestly, because it's such a private, a lot of people overshare, we know who they are.
Right.
I've been one of them in the past myself, when you just get so aggravated and social media is accessible to everybody now all the time,
right?
All the time, even pre-COVID. So, it's not always safe to share in those environments, even though we have private Facebook groups that for a ton of support groups are out there. Facebook groups, we meet in person. COVID's kind of put a damper on some of that, but we're trying to congregate again safely. And I will say that, sure, there's been times when I've shared with other friends and thought it was a safe space, and it was not. It turns out to be that it was not. So it's better to seek the advice of a counselor and someone who's completely not emotionally or knows you, isn't tied to you at all. I just want to add real quick, you mentioned seeing a counselor, which I think everybody should seek some assistance, but Grief Recovery Method itself is a more of an action-oriented program, and we go through a specific, real targeted curriculum. You have to do the work in order to see the benefits. It's not traditional therapy. So I just want to make that clear. Okay. And that's why it's so profound and powerful and has such an impact. If you're ready to do the work, it will change you. So I just want to mention that. And we do it one-on-one as well as small groups.
And that's so very true. Even in traditional counseling, that if you just go and you talk and you don't listen to any advice or suggestions that your counselor says, or you don't tell the truth, that's not going to be very helpful either. But I appreciate that you brought that out, because I want to make sure that people 100% understand that it's not a osmosis type of situation. You're not going to get better just by sitting there and somehow absorbing by doing nothing. You actually have to put some effort in and do some exercises and change ways of thinking, I'm guessing.
We show people a different, you've mentioned unhealthy ways to cope. We've all been there and done that. We call them STERBs, short-term energy relieving behaviors. And those are things like watching too much TV, drinking, drugs, sex, all the different things that we do to fill our time up, shopping, to avoid dealing with the grief. All of those things are just short-term relievers. And we want to put those aside because those aren't working for you. Years, months pass, years pass, and you still feel the same way you did when so-and-so left, or when so-and-so, whether that be a death, divorce, health issue, a job change. There's over 40 different losses, believe it or not. And I was like, what?
Wow.
when I entered this program, there's a ton of different losses. And those short-term energy relievers, I've been there, done that. And still, years later, I'm still like, okay, I need to deal with this because it's affecting my life. We say in GRM that grief is cumulative and usually cumulatively negative. And it impacts every area of your life, your work, your personal life, your family, all of the relationships, whether romantic or not, friendships. It impacts negatively. And that's why I feel so strongly about trying to help other people get through that stuff. And the quicker you can get through it, you can get to the other side and live hopefully a fuller life without the baggage
right.
that we carry around. So,
yeah. And we all have baggage. Some of it's good, but yeah, a lot of it seems to be bad. And that's, I think, where the baggage comes, the idea comes from, is that it's heavy, you lug it around, it's, you know, uncomfortable. And so tell the audience and tell me, if you can, some of the steps. I don't know how much you're allowed to tell.
I didn't know I was going to come on and talk about the steps of the program. I'm not really prepared to do that, nor do I think that's going to be really helpful to your listeners.
Okay.
What I thought might be helpful, and you can tell me if this is not, is basically where I came from and why I was such in the depths of despair that I found this to be helpful to me, and I wanted to help others with it.
Yeah. And that's fine too. I just wasn't sure how personal you wanted to get. So I didn't want to ask that question.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay.
I don't think coming on here and not being personal is going to be helpful to anyone, because my story and my son's story, frankly, which are very intertwined in the beginning and still, is why I'm here today and why I feel, again, so much better and so much more able to do an interview like this without... And honestly say, I'm at a different space and different place than I was even 7 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So
awesome. That's fabulous. So my question that I've had on the tip of my tongue since, you know, starting the process of getting you on the show and everything is, I feel like that so often when a family suddenly has the news that someone will be born with a disability, or that after the child is already born and then it's discovered that the child has a disability, that there is that sense of loss. And I wrote a book called Those Who Can't Teach, and it's true stories. I interviewed 9 different families or individuals, and the family members talked about that. You know, the moms and the dads that I interviewed talked about, you know, I thought without even realizing I was thinking it, that my child was going to be whatever. Mm-hmm. And now my child is this. And there's the whole, you know, Welcome to Holland poem, or I don't know if it's called a poem, but, and so I feel like this is something that is known and experienced in the community of people with disabilities, but those who are outside that community don't experience it. And those that are experiencing it don't talk about it because I'm sure there's a myriad of reasons.
There's a lot of pain associated with it. It's hard to talk about these things, and pain is not, and grief is not an acceptable thing, again, to show feelings. We're in the business of emotions, right, Shelley?
Right.
I'm in the business of emotions. We're taught from an early age not to show your emotions. Don't cry. Don't do this. Go to your room. We don't want to see this. So from an early age, we're taught that. And no one teaches us how to cope in healthy ways with our emotions and our grief. My son, for instance, on the autism spectrum, didn't speak the word until he was four, but we have still on our he's talkative now, but we have on our refrigerator a from the speech therapist. Sorry, my mind is going blank. I can see the picture. We talk about the zones of regulation that he's in, and it's a way to express for those who don't have a lot of expressive language what they're feeling. So the anger or sick or mad, glad, happy, right, whatever, and they're by color. So I'm like, I wish everybody could have this. Everybody could teach this to every single kid, and this would be so more helpful than what we're doing. Right. It's not just for kids with autism or special needs, because we all need it. Anyway,
Gina, there's truly, coming from the special education background, there are so many things that if we would do these things with every student, then every student could be even more successful, but yet we still think, oh no, this is just for those that have an IEP or those that are struggling or whatever. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be phenomenal if we all had that?
Right. Yes, I agree.
Especially after coming out of COVID, because we all need some more counseling too, because we've all experienced this traumatic event and we're still experiencing it. So our kids are, you've seen the news, even in my own high school, I was like shocked about what was happening last week. And I'm like, okay, I have to remember that these kids are still, nobody has addressed their mental health, and some of them are not, doing so well. So anyway, I went off course, but back to your original question about, or just comment about finding out at birth. I want to be clear that my son had different challenges and a different way of entering this world that didn't necessarily tell us that he was going to have autism. It wasn't until he was, 1 year of age that we knew this isn't just delays. So can I just briefly describe?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. My question was, that you experienced it whenever you heard that things didn't go the way, like I said, that you either planned or that you unintentionally were planning.
Right. So Kenneth is my only son. I was a first-time mother. I was in a very traumatic near-death car accident 18 years ago. He's 17, and that changed my life. It was in November, actually. Just come to think of it, it's November. And that was 18 years ago. I went through the experience. I have a cervical fusion because of it. And when I came out of that, we were trying to get pregnant, but they do the whole thing. Like, are you pregnant? Let's do the test. Da, da, da. I'm in the hospital. I come out and I'm recovering. I have a neck brace and I have a walker and a boot on my leg, on my right side, because I didn't break any bones, but I was told I had to wear a boot. Anyway, that's the kind of condition I was in. And it was traumatic. I won't get into the details. I'll just say that again, I had to stop working. We had just bought a house in Dallas. We had just moved here not long before that. And my mother had passed away as well. And so I'd left my friends, my family, my job. I knew I was going to leave my job because my husband at the time had just taken a new job in Dallas. We were looking forward to something new and getting closer to his family that lives in Oklahoma. So it was a very positive time, yet this happened. And I'm serious, not just 4 to 6 months after buying the new house. So we hadn't even put anything in the house. And then I was like disabled. So a month after being home and being on heavy pain meds, I discovered that I'm pregnant. And we do the test and it's confirmed. You are pregnant. So out of tragedy comes this beautiful thing. Yet I was scared to death because I'm on heavy pain meds, class C category drugs, and trying to heal from this traumatic event. So we went through that whole thing and got off the meds and with the advice of the doctors and just trying to do the best we could do. And my belly, I'm growing as I'm still recovering from the accident and doing physical therapy. So I'm going to physical therapy, 7 a.m. every day, whatever. And everything seems to be progressing as it should. However, about 7 months in, my water breaks and we have to rush to the hospital. So my son was born early. He was a 31 weeker. And he was 4 pounds, 1 ounce, and he was just going to burst into this world. He was ready. There was no stopping him. I'm a first-time mom. I'm scared to death. My husband is scared to death. Everybody's like, what happened? We just saw you like last week. The whole family had a barbecue here in Dallas, and it was a wonderful time. And I was like, didn't have my baby shower yet, blah, blah, blah. So that was what was happening. That's how he entered into the world. Other side of it that was traumatic for me, it was just layer upon layer, like I said, cumulative grief. And now I can explain it a little easier without bursting, without just getting choked up. But he was in the NICU for 5 weeks. So I had to go back and forth to the hospital every day to feed him and pump and do all this. And I couldn't drive. I had PTSD. I could not get in a car and drive. I couldn't even be a passenger and not have anxiety. So somehow, some way, they got, you know, my neighbor, everybody chipped in. They gave me rides to Presby. And he was born in Presby, Dallas. Fantastic NICU there. They took good care of us for 5 weeks. And then he came home. Life was good. Everything's, you know, we think normal. He's just delayed a couple of months. But he was not catching up. And it was 1 year where we knew he didn't have any words. He wasn't looking at us. He was just kind of not spaced out, but pretty much that. And I thought, this is just not right. Something's wrong. And we were seen, by the way, as all people with preemies are, by a developmental pediatrician, a very good one here in Dallas. And so we saw her every few months, and it was just exhausting. When I think about it, I'm like, how the heck did we get through that? And you think about from there until now, he's 17, and the ARDS and all the things that come in between, that is exhausting every year. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we did it other than just being on overdrive and just in one ear, out the other. And let's, okay, what do we do today? Literally, we had no family in town to support us. Like, it was really tough. No church at that time. Like, the things that I have now that I embrace and I appreciate, and I would not leave this town for my life, even if you offered me a job somewhere for $1 million, to recreate that circle of support again would be, no, I couldn't do it. And my kids' friends are here now. So back to this early years, it was tough. We found out at 15 months, because they were, you know, doing all the measurements and checking him all the time, that, you know, his head seems a little bit big, Miss Waterman, Mr. and Mrs. Waterman. It may not be anything, but let's just check on this. And the doctor's like, let me go seek the other guy's opinion. It was right before Thanksgiving. It was this time of the year, and we were planning a trip. We were going to see my father-in-law in upstate New York. And I remember like being excited, taking the baby, just having some downtime. And they told us we need to have an MRI. Just to be sure, just to be safe, or a CT scan, I think they started with. And I'm like, why? What's going on? Well, you know, it's charting 98 percentile. We just want to make sure nothing's going on. My son was happy, relatively healthy, I thought. He just wasn't speaking and hitting the milestones and not walking. He didn't walk till 2, speak till 4. But I thought, okay, he's just going to catch up. Well, come to find out, you know, we need to go in right away. We did. And he never demonstrated any pain. This is what kills me still to this day, because he was a happy baby. Everybody was always like, he's so happy. His left hemisphere was completely filled with fluid. He had to have a craniectomy. There was a mass in his left side, and his brainstem was even shifted a little bit. And that was at 15 months. So they told us, this is very serious. We need to see the North Texas neurosurgeons of North Texas. There's only a few of them, and they're here, and they're phenomenal. And we wound up with Dr. Sacco, who was brilliant. And they're like, you have to schedule the surgery immediately. And I said, okay, how do we go see your family and your dad and not say anything? And we're like, okay, we have to buckle down and we're just going to do this. So that was rough. You know, it was November. He had the surgery. It was a one night, overnight. Our family came. A lot of friends came to support us and help us and stay the night at the hospital so that I could go home and rest. And he made it out of that just fine.
Wow. I'm so sorry. That is a lot. I mean, yeah. I am feeling exhausted just hearing what you're saying and thinking about all of, I don't have a background in counseling, but because I've gone for so many years, I kind of get some of the psychology. Plus I obviously took some psychology classes because of being a special education teacher. And I just, the mental health side of all of those things, like you said, that cumulative, it was, you know, it was this thing and then it was this thing and then it was this thing and then it was this thing. And about the time you're feeling like, oh, okay, all those things were, you
you're
know,
above, I'm going to deal with water,
them.
Right?
Right, exactly. Then
that's
you get
exactly
hit with,
what I am.
You, like, then you get right hit with another one. Yeah. And I mean, oh my gosh, Gina, that's, and you're not even probably, you know, halfway into your story. So
I know, I'm sorry. I want to make it short. It's just not short with Kenneth.
No.
Nothing short with Kenneth. And that's why I say, when people ask me, so is it the autism? Was it this? Was it that? I'm like, you call it whatever you want. He had traumatic brain injury and he had in utero trauma when I was recovering from my stuff. All the things I was feeling and doing and thinking and taking care of, Shelly, he was experiencing everything in utero. So I feel really strongly about, I thank you for letting me tell some of this story because I haven't shared it with a ton of people. I have in the past. In a blog and early on to help others and also just to get it out and try to heal myself. However, it's poignant and it's wonderful and it's beautiful because we have made it to the other side ish. It's still, he still has the label of autism. It's still a struggle. We just did our ARD. We're not done with it. We have to meet one more time to finish up the loose ends. He's 17. He's a thriving senior in high school in a great high school in Richardson. So he's going to walk the stage, in May with his peers. He's with best buddies. He's involved in karate. He just got his green belt. And I don't know if you can probably not see it, but I got a picture of him from the tournament with his green belt. It's huge. The things that he's done, we never thought possible. We didn't know what was going to happen. And it just, that's why it's like kind of cool to be telling this and even part of the story because he's doing so well and I'm so proud of him and it's not so scary anymore. It still hurts. But I've done a lot of work on myself. I still continue to do some maintenance on myself because things crop up. They always do. Anyway, that was.
No. And Gina, I want you to tell as much of your story in the way that you want to tell it. So, I wanted to, I don't want to give you, I don't want to say condolences. One of the reasons that I do this show is because I want people's perspectives to be changed, but I also want my guests to share their story, maybe for the first time ever, or in a way that maybe they've not been able to share it before. And so you tell as many details as you want to tell, and you take a rest when you need to take a rest, and you keep going when you need to keep going. So I kind of, the other reason I sort of interrupted you with that, empathetic, I'm sorry, is because I kind of seem like you needed a slight bit of a break there. So I didn't want to stop the momentum, but at the same time.
No, that's okay. Yeah. I need to have that as well. I need to remember that. And thank you for that. So where did we leave off? I guess, like I said, he came out of that experience, well, it wasn't great, but he, as any child of 15 months that has no language and no idea what's going on. It was just crazy. He got, he came home, he was very sick from the anesthesia and all that. He was had vomiting and all, like, we took care of all those things. And they said, he's going to be okay. The fluid's going to, there's something called a shunt that they put in for a lot of kids who have had the same surgery. Luckily, he didn't have to have that done because that also could introduce infection and so on and having to care for it every day. So we were lucky with that, knock on wood. But we were followed for 6 months after, and then yearly after that. And we saw Dr. Sacco for the last time in November of 2011. I had literally just pulled the folder because somebody else was asking me about that and the neurological stuff that he'd experienced. And we thought he was cleared. You know, there's not been any new additional things. He seems to be progressing, though very, very slowly on the language side. Even the doctor's notes, I was looking at him over and I'm like, okay. Even he was like, I think he should be further along language wise. Like, I can't explain it. We don't know, but he's doing well and nothing else is happening that we can see. So we're going to release you. If something comes up, please call us. Da, 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 da. So those were the early years. That takes us up to, like I said, 2011. I'll just say that was really hard to get through. And I still feel like I have, and I'm sure my ex, he's never done any of this kind of work. His dad, and I'm laughing and this nervous laughter, but it would be wonderful for him to look at that as well when he's ready, and you have to be ready. But I think that has really impacted the way he sees his son today. I know that for me, it has. And I know for other parents that have a story, everybody has their own story, and I'm not going to discount their story or try to compare my story to theirs, because every individual's an individual, both in our kids and each parent experiences things very differently, but we carry these things with us. And I know for me, well, I carried that story for so long, like, oh, my poor son, my delicate, fragile son. When in fact he was okay. And he, you know, we got past that point and he was learning and thriving and moving forward, although really, really slow. And I still am like, gosh, I wish it was a little bit faster. But we all wish that, you know, we're all like, oh, sure. If we could just get to this level, if we could just get them to this grade level of reading or whatever it is, comprehension, expressive language, et cetera, et cetera. But physically, he had to wear, you know, the AFOs, and he had, like, people that see him now or saw him in karate that he just started like 4 years ago, they don't know what he was like when he was little. I'm like, he right. couldn't even hold himself up. Like, the kid had like a lot of challenges. And they're like, really? He's worn glasses since he was, you know, like 9 months old. So for strabismus and other things. So those, we went through the years, and I'll just say the other cumulative grief and trauma that happened after he hit about age seven. It was like 5 to 7 were some dicey years as well, when I thought, okay, I'm not just floating above water, but I'm actually like feeling more like myself. I can get back to maybe some work and some other things instead of having autism completely just engulf me. And that's the experience of a lot of parents and a lot of moms. It just, you know, one parent goes off and does their job and provides for insurance and, you know, money for the out-of-pocket expenses, which there are many and huge, and it's always an issue. Like, what are we going to do next? What's the next thing we're going to try? You know, it goes beyond speech therapy, OT, physical therapy, ABA, nutritional support. When he was 4 years old and not talking, and we had started PPCD because, as you know, as an educator, you start early development
intervention, early services.
Thank you. Yeah. ECI was at our house when he was a baby, but the 3-year-old, like, you're going to go to school now. And I'm like, he can't talk. He's not even potty trained. How's he going to survive at school? Well, they have a program here called PPCD. I don't know what it's called there, but it's just basically preschool for kids with disabilities. And we were in an autism unit in a very highly regarded elementary school, Lakewood in Dallas. But they're not a special ed anything. I still remember the first R that we were in ever with the administrator, who said she had a special ed degree from years back and she knew about this and that and the other. And I was like, and it was at that point where I was like, okay, now I know what it feels like when they say you have to advocate for your kid. And he was only 3. And I was already like, wait a minute. What do you mean he's got to do, like, that's not right for him. That's not right for Kenneth. And you may have a special ed degree, and I fully, you know, understand and respect that, but I have a PhD in my son. Like, I see him every day, every hour. Yes. I know everything about him, what he's doing, what he's eating, what he's, how he's pooping, like all those things that you keep track of as a mother, right? I know.
Yes.
Because again, he's not able to express himself and so on. And I'm supposed to send him to school to you guys. And he's three. And anyway, so you could see that was another level of loss, not what we expected at age three, to be tossing him over there for the day or even half a day to go to school. We did everything we were supposed to do, Shelley. We did more. And I was the one doing a lot of that legwork because I was like, we can certainly afford to have some help, but I can't let anyone else do this. No one else is going to take care of him like I can take care of him. He's my son. So we agreed. And that, again, another level of grief, another level of stress on the marriage, which a lot of other parents have shared with me the experience as well. And it continues to go on. I don't know what more I should. I want to stop there, I guess, because he was seven when things started to really break down in our marriage. And it wasn't autism that broke our marriage. We already had a lot of breaks prior to that. So it was at that stage where we were like, and we tried, like everyone does, multiple times to keep it together for the sake of kids. And I come from a Hispanic background, raised, Catholic, and you just don't do that. You don't consider it. And I felt like I was failing my parents, my family, in even considering doing this. But it was the only way that that we were going to survive as a family. And that was the first time I knew it. It took us many years later to actually get it done. It was only been 3 or 4 years since we've been officially divorced, but it was a process. Again, another loss that I didn't really work on until 4 years ago when I went to the training. So I just wanted to mention that as well, that had an impact on my son. He might have special needs, but it still impacted him. And we've done everything under the sun to make sure that he's, not just well cared for, but also that he can express and get out what he needs to get out in a healthy way, help him to transition to what that looks like post-divorce, because my ex has since remarried. I have not. We live in separate houses and so on and so forth. We started to train him with the idea that this was going to happen, and the back and forth and mommy's house, daddy's house. And we did that. And I think we did a really good job as best as we could. I really do, because my son, I don't know, he's even with the autism, he's quite adept at,
perception of what's going
not just perception. They feel it completely, even if they're nonverbal. But the idea that he's just adaptable. He's more adaptable mm-hmm. than most kids. That doesn't mean he didn't cry or have fits or do his thing.
Sure. And
there's time to change households, because he was struggling too with all this. But I think we did a good job of just focusing on him, especially when he was younger and even before the divorce, like just making sure he understood he's loved, he's cared for, he's going to be safe, and school is there, his friends are there, church was there. At that time, church was extremely important source of support. It still is. We don't go as often right now because of COVID, but it's a huge source of support for us. And so having him be involved in those things and have consistency and schedule and routine beyond just school. I mean, like, Sunday school. And I was making sure he showed up to those things, because he needs people other than just us. We were a mess. I can say that we were a mess. And so as much as we try to, you can't hide it from your kids. You can't hide it from other people. You can put on that mask, and we all do it, right? We all try to put that mask on and be like, oh, I'm okay. I'm feeling all right today. No, this is traumatic for our family. We need help. We need support. And so they were loving, caring individuals, and they still today check in on us. And, I've had some other surgeries and personal health issues recently that they're still there for me, praying, supporting, coming by, delivering a meal, whatever. And that's huge. That's huge compared to where we were at the start of the story. Yeah. So I'll end there. I think that's enough. There's been some more physical challenges. I've had my father's passed away during that time as well. He was very involved in Kenneth as the sole grandfather, because my mom passed away, as I said, when we moved to Dallas in 2002. So she was gone. But my dad was like always here. He lived in New Jersey, where I grew up mainly. And he would be down here all the time helping, assisting, you know, when he was in the hospital, of course, that was a huge thing. So he came down and stayed for several weeks for that. And losing him around 2015, that was another tough one that brought up. And this is what also happens. It bubbles up and brings up, triggers other things that you haven't dealt with. And that's what led me to GRM. So again, I probably sound like a salesperson, but it literally is how I wound up. Like I had my ex had just, we finally said, this is it. It's done. But he, unfortunately, the timing of it was around when my dad died, and his memorial service was like two months after. And Ken walked out the door around that time. So I had to deal with Kenneth, my feelings, my mess, and it was not fun. And I was the executor of his estate. I had that extra bonus, you know, thrown in there.
My. So yeah,
for like another year and a half, I was just on automatic mode again, just trying to get through that stuff so I could just seal it up and put that away. Flying back and forth to Jersey, dealing with a house and all these other things. So it was crazy. But my son is a trooper, because I also want to say, like, some people would protect, try to bubble their kid, and I see them do this, and I'm like, don't do that, please don't do that. You can't make them, you can't explain it unless they experience it. But allowing your child to grieve and see the grief events is huge. And even before I discovered GRM, I felt this and understood it from my own parents and my own family, that you cannot, you need to allow the child, if they've lost somebody or someone has died, to experience even just a little bit of that, especially the funeral, if they're cremated, going to do with the ashes, etc. The rituals that we experience, and the dinners and the seeing people and all that. I made sure that Kenneth went with me. I made sure he was there. He may not have understood everything, but he surely knew what was happening. He knew his grandfather. So I was like, you can't. My ex was like, you don't want to do this, or maybe not do this. And I was like, how can we? He experienced, he knows this. He loved him. We need to help him process this as best we can with a child with autism. And that was in 2015. So he was, he was a lot younger. So I just want to say that's huge. Another component of this grief recovery. We don't, in my business, I don't work with a child. I have another workshop, if you will, that teaches educators and parents and caregivers how to deal with that, and how children grieve, and how best to deal with that situation. So that's another component that's very, that's been very successful with people. And it's near and dear to my heart, because I just recently, 6 years ago, experienced that and continue to, because he still has questions about where's grandpa, or not where's grandpa, but
sure.
I want grandpa to come from heaven. You know, he wants him back.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a couple things that I just want to clarify for anybody who might be watching who's not from Texas, because what you're calling an ARD meeting is it's the annual review meeting. And in a lot of other parts of the country, they just call them annual review meetings. And I'm not really sure what if the A and the R stand for annual review. But it's basically just your meeting with your IEP team to go over the IEP and address anything, you know, and prepare for the upcoming year. So I just wanted to clear that up for anybody.
Sorry.
No, yes, you're totally fine.
I think it's annual I forget what the acronym stands for, but yeah, it's review and dismissal or something like that.
Yeah, which I think you're right. It, because that D, I'm like, well, how can it be and dismissal? Because we're not going to dismiss every year. But I, yeah, it's just one of those those acronyms. But as a master IEP coach, that's one of the things that I do is try to remember that, you know, like you talked about your PPCD, that's not what we call it in Illinois. That's not, you know, but again, it's just that early intervention early services childhood. And, you know, other places call it something different and they have their own acronyms. And, you know, so that's one of my things that I always try to be cognizant of is that every profession has their own acronyms and every group of people eventually develops their own shorthand. But, you know, we have to make sure that everybody's on the same page when, especially when we're talking at these meetings, because it's usually none of us that will be affected by the outcome of the meeting. It's the student. So making sure that everybody at that table is understanding and is on the same page so that whomever we're writing that IEP for can have the benefit that we hope to give them. There was just besides the R, there was something else funny. I can't think of.
I was just going to interject there. It's funny you say that because at the meeting last week, I was like, it was our second or third meeting because of timing. It's not because we're difficult. I promise you, we're not a difficult family. We'd make it hard on them and it goes for hours and hours, but they had a limited time and the administrator couldn't stay. And you know how legally they have to have someone there. So we had to stop and keep stopping. But I, at the last meeting, I made sure to bring in pictures of Kenneth and I set them on a table. And I said, and the recent one with the green belt karate, I said, I just want to thank you guys for this. I know it's gone on a little longer than we wanted to, but I appreciate everybody's effort. And this, I want to remind us, all of us who we're working for Kenneth. And here it is, like just having that vivid picture in front of you. I've always tried to do that in past arts, but now I kind of, you know, in middle school and high school forgot about that part of it. And I'm like, this is great. So it was a nice way to gently remind them and they're appreciative of it. Cause they're like, oh, there he is, you know, a baby or there he is in middle school or whatever.
Yeah. So it's, that's a wonderful idea to definitely do that because it does help remind us all why we're at that particular meeting.
All right. I always say who I'm working for.
Exactly.
Anyway.
So it sounds like, I don't want to rush you, but I kind of have to.
That's fine.
You're fine. Cause we only have about 12 or so minutes before I typically wrap up. So I just want to make sure that, I mean, I know you've already talked about some of the things that he's already doing that people didn't anticipate that he would be able to do. I mean, the karate, the sitting up, that was the other thing you had mentioned was the AFOs, which are braces. For anybody who doesn't know what those can be braces on the feet, on the trunk of the body. It is, you know, it's just to help give them that stabilization so that their body can grow and develop and do what it needs to do that they don't always hopefully have to have those AFOs. But I knew there was something else that you had said and I couldn't think of it earlier. So just kind of fast forward to kind of now the last 3 years and the grief recovery method and what you do, and then make sure that you tell people, especially for anybody that's in your area, but if you can help clients outside your area, how they can get in touch with you.
Okay. As I said, COVID kind of put a damper on our small groups and the one-on-ones that we were doing in person. However, we started like everybody else doing grief recovery through Zoom. And I offer that as well. You can go to griefrecoverymethod.com and do a search within your area. You just type in your zip code and it'll find a GRM specialist in your area. That's the first way to get to it. If you want to get to me, you type in Texas Garland and you'll find, or Dallas, you'll find me there. I have a microsite on their site. So that's the first thing. They can also call me and I'll give you, you have all my information. They can call me directly if they want to, or email me at movingpastgrief@gmail.com. So that's my business email they can reach me at. I help people mainly right now. I've been doing a lot more one-on-ones, but I do some small group, 1 hour, the 5 myths about grief. I call it a workshop. It's not really a workshop. It's just talking about grief and what are the 5 myths about grief and how do we, how do we correct that and also see that there's another way to deal with it and cope with it and talk about our program and at a high level, what that means. What does it mean to take action? So for a one-on-one, it might be 7 or 8 sessions. It actually is whatever many sessions you need, but that we say about 7 or 8. For a small group, it might be a little bit more. And I do, you know, right now, again, I haven't been doing a whole lot of small groups, but I'm opening it up to maybe 4 or 5 people max. We do it in the evenings, which tends to be where a lot of people are free, or the weekends. And I, in the Dallas area, I'm hoping to now open up a little bit more and do at least once a month for my support groups and my special needs moms and parents and different nonprofits, opening up, again, discussions about just general discussions about grief and how it relates to special needs parents and what does it mean, what all the stuff I'm talking about. So in addition to that, there's just the general, you know, helping people cope with death, recent death, divorce, some health challenge or a job loss or a pet loss. We also do pet loss. I haven't personally had a lot of experience doing that, but I have people that I can send them to if they need that assistance, because that's another, another group that feels minimized or they just don't talk a lot about this, but pet loss is a huge, huge deal. It's like losing a member of your family. So we offer that as well. There's a curriculum for that as well. It's a much shorter session. I think it's like 3 or 4 sessions that they can go through with that. But again, it's as much as you need. So I do it. There's several other people in the area that do it. I found a lady in Addison that I've been working with who's fantastic. And she's actually, we have helped each other also kind of do some of our own cleanup work during COVID since we had the time. So I have other people that I can source to as well if it's something that I don't necessarily specialize in. But my passion and my thing is to help special needs parents with the losses that we talked about. So,
yeah. And like I said earlier, you know, it's something that I don't think is talked about. Why do you think it's not talked about?
Well, we spoke in the very beginning of this interview about the stigma and people feeling embarrassed or ashamed that they need help and admitting that they need help or that they can't get by without a drink that day. This is a common one that's unfortunately kind of joked about, you know, the right. People with the wine every night. And that's not healthy. And I know for a fact, I just know the impact that has on a person. Having grown up in an alcoholic family, both my parents died of cirrhosis of the liver from drinking. And my mother way too young. My father lasted a lot longer, but still the effects were huge. The impact on the family is huge and it goes far reaching. So I know that firsthand, what damages that can do. I didn't choose drinking. I chose a lot of other things. So I chose some other unhealthy route things as well. So enough said about that. I mean, just again, people, it's not cool to talk about your emotions. It's, you know, we're supposed to be striving forward and just push through it. You know, you hear the language, just get through it, be busy, work harder. You'll forget about it. Or when you lose a pet, go get another dog, go get another cat. You'll be fine. It doesn't work that way. There's right. Emotional work and completeness that has to be done with that individual or the pet or the relationship. And if it's a person that's died versus a person that's living that you still have to see every week, like my ex, it was impacting me tremendously every day. And in fact, I want to bring that up too, because that was another eye opener for me. When I went to do the workshop, I was like, I have 5 or 6 or 7 losses, like big ones. Which one do I even start with, Cole?
Sure.
I was like, I don't even know where to start. And he's like, which one's impacting you the most daily? That's the one you start with. I said, oh, that's easy. That's my ex. And so I did that because I had to see him. I still had to exchange, you know, we still had to take care of our kid and figure out how are we going to co-parent this child who loves us both and wants us to be together under the same roof still. He understands we're not well together and we're fighting, but he doesn't understand why we can't still be together. And even to this day, sometimes that comes up. So, it's enlightening. And as I said, I hope that I can help other people, because it's been freeing. Just knowing now, like, okay, and I'm not perfect, nobody is, but it takes it way down a notch, like the level of interaction we have now versus back then. It was like we're constantly fighting and yelling at each other, blaming each other for stuff, and it's just like, no, you take responsibility for your own stuff, Gina. You have to do it, and you have to do it in a healthy way. And sometimes it takes not, you know, turning on silent on the phone or whatever it takes, and not texting. Texting is not always the greatest method of communication, as you know. Right. And when you're heated and angry, it's horrible. People say things they shouldn't say. And then it's misinterpreted all the time. So there's those things. But I will add, literally the reason I'm doing this and want to do more of this is because parents need to grieve and cope in healthy ways. But our health depends upon it. And I mentioned I had some health struggles coming out of the divorce, and also a surgery like right away. And then I had 3 years later, another surgery, like different things that we tend to put ourselves second. And while we're nurturing and taking care of our child, son or daughter with autism or any other special needs. And I was doing a whole lot more extra stuff like nutritional support and so on. And all these things that I met other parents doing, and I thought maybe that'll help him, and it did tremendously. But I just wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't even taking my own vitamins when I should have been doing. You know, it's crazy. Right. You're giving him stuff and paying for all this stuff, and you're not doing it yourself. So that's a simplistic way to say it, but that's where it started. And so years of cumulative not taking care of yourself eventually is going to bite you in the butt, and it does. And here we are. So that's one more reason why I want to take care of our parents, because I know what it's like to discover, oh crap, I need to deal with this. Otherwise, mm-hmm. who's going to be there for him? I need to take care of myself. He only does as well as I do. And that's it. Like, we have to take care of ourselves too. It's like that whole, the whole scenario of when you're in the plane.
Yeah. I was just thinking that.
Like, yeah. Who do you put that oxygen mask on first? You, and then your son, your daughter. But it takes something to happen in order to make you get up and do it. You know, something has to happen traumatically. And for me, whatever reason, I was a magnet and I had lots of things happening to me.
You did.
From the get-go. But now I know how to better deal with it if it happens, because life's going to happen. But I am grateful that I'm not hit constantly. Other people, it just hasn't happened yet. Like the bomb hasn't happened. There's going to be something that happens and you're going to have to pick up the pieces and keep going for your kid, for yourself, for your parent, for whatever. So thank you for letting me say that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is time for us to wrap up. So I have put over in the chat, griefrecoverymethod.com. And I'm just going to double check that everything is spelled correctly. So that is for if anyone wants to find someone like you in their area.
Locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then for you specifically, it's movingpastgrief@gmail.com. And that's to reach you through Gmail. I thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. I was listening and I was getting, like I said, I was exhausted just hearing a lot of the things that you went through, but then some of the stuff that you talked about triggered for that word, things that I had kind of experienced, not to the extent, not to the depth, or not exactly like you, but similarly. And so I was feeling pain with you. And I can only imagine, you know, what you have gone through, and I'm so happy that you found this method, and I'm so pleased that you wanted to come on and share about it to help others, because I really think it is something that needs to be addressed much more regularly and so much more in our disabled community, because I don't think it's talked about enough, that it's okay to grieve that loss. So thank you again. And we will next week. Oh, I can't. No, I just went blank on who I have next week. But anyway, join me next week on Bag No Limits. Thanks again, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.